Right now it is time to bring in David Taratruk with The Media Beat. Of course, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us, also on Huffington Post. You can find him, of course, right here on Robin Hood Radio Live on Friday, rebroadcast on the weekends, and also at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Taratruk. He's also, ladies and gentlemen, a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, it's good to be back with you.
It's good to have you live.
Right. What's that like?
It's very nice to be had back. Yes.
That was a streak there.
No gremlins, no oversleeping, no other problems to get
no
in our way.
Oh no, we
except I hear that you have been having lots of problems at your end. Of all different kinds.
Right. We've got the toilet seat now and the sad face. This is my favorite, though. My screen.
Do you think the toilet seat is a fit subject for the Media Beat investigation and discussion?
No, I think that the sad face. That's a discussion about actually.
We can discuss world politics later.
That's a discussion.
As I'm sure people have said to you, if you buy your toilets or even just your toilet seat from Amazon, then you've got it coming. You know, you've got trouble. You're about to be in a difficult position.
You are about to be in a difficult position because you've got to do something with it. But I would like to sort of apropos, there are two things. But first, I would like to just complain that I think it's really undignified at this stage of my life to have a screen that makes a sad face because it encountered a problem and has to shut down. Which is what my computer is doing. So anything I might have wanted to look at for you. Sorry, we're being updated when it feels like it. And this leads me to something I heard this morning on what used to be called National Public Radio, but is now called NPR, Morning Edition.
Rather on the model of Kentucky Fried Chicken is no longer Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Right,
it's KFC, right?
And what I heard...
There must be a reason for that.
I guess. And, you know, once again...
For the likeness, I mean. For the modeling.
It must be for their demographic, which
oh,
I guess I
say.
Am...
They, well, you know, actually what it is it's very clear from NPR management. They just don't want to be known as a radio company. It's as simple as that.
Well, that's unfortunate.
What are they? Well, you might think they're a radio network, but no, we're not a radio network.
What are they then?
We're a multimedia platform, of course.
Exactly.
Come on.
Yeah, multimedia platform, and that's what gets us radio people really upset because they're giving away our content that we pay for and we pay handsomely for. They give it away free to these internet providers, and it just drives us.
Oh dear, I wasn't intending to touch a raw nerve.
but it's totally stupid.
But do go ahead. Go on.
All right, but it's a stupid.
I'll stop.
No. It's as far as a business model is concerned, it's stupid. You'll forgive me, because which we learned many millions of years ago with Napster. If you give something away free, people will take it. But when you turn around and say, well, great, can you pay for that now? Because we're totally, we can't afford this. No, we don't want it. We don't want it if it does cost something. It is as infantile as having an unhappy face because the computer has to restart. It doesn't work that way. Anyway, what I heard this morning on National Public Radio was...
you Luddite. Okay, go ahead. Call it National Public Radio. I don't care.
I'm a fiend. They can come get me. Was a dialogue... I don't even want to dignify it calling it a dialogue. That went something like this. This Russian thing. When will it end? Where do we go? When will it end? And I thought, wow, that's news? And so what I really wondered was, in your other country, because, there's a long and storied history of media, is it this stupid? I mean, has it devolved to this level of I'm not sure what? Inanity?
Well, I'm not sure. My other country, my old home country of Great Britain, of course, as you say, a long established media history of its own. In some ways, they claim to be the world's first in many things, but world's first newspapers, world's first magazines, and so on. Yes, I mean, it doesn't mean that in any way, you know, UK is a paradigm for excellence in media. It certainly isn't. But on the other hand, they do have pockets of some of the best in the world, some of the best in the world ever, arguably. But what's been true, I suspect, ever since Joseph Addison published The Spectator way back in the 18th century, there would be this perpetual tension between piling in on stories, which is a sort of normal human response to something going on that requires attention. Everybody gets into it and does pile on. And yeah, there's an excess. I mean, I'm not suggesting that Addison's Spectator was anything like 24-hour cable news, but they could overdo things and people would complain about the overdoing. Now, of course, we have it all, you know, illuminated and lit large with all our media platforms, I guess. There's a tendency just to go on and on and on about things because on cable news, of course, there's space to fill. In more digital realms, there are eyeballs to capture. And the overreach of the constant berating the viewer, listener, reader with the same topic again and again and again from different angles, sometimes very often not different angles. And it's often accompanied, before long, often very early these days, it's the other voice saying, ah, come on, you know, let's get on to something new. I mean, the perpetual requirement for novelty instead of thoroughness and depth, or in preference to thoroughness and depth, is a human reaction, and I think one that's exaggerated by the media, as most human frailties are.
And what does, again, doesn't matter for people who have either, who are interested in reading, this sounds unfriendly, and I don't mean it to be, but it's fine for people who are used to consuming their news and know what it should sound like. I have these discussions from time to time with people who cook. You know, how are you supposed to know what it tastes like now? Because it's been so XYZ. People don't think about that, but I do. So you're fine for the people who have grown up questioning the news and requiring some depth. A perfect example, I thought yesterday, that I saw on certain cable networks, talked about how the president had appointed his personal physician to the post of, what was it, to run the VA.
To run the VA, the Veterans Administration.
The second biggest agency in the government.
Right. And all I could think of was the guy who wrote during the campaign, President Trump is healthy because it's his personal, you know, that was his personal physician.
Well, since he's been in office, Dr. Admiral Dr. Ronny Jackson was the one who proclaimed him to be a really fit president. I mean, he's treated three presidents after all. He presumably does have some reliable points of comparison, but he also said that, He thought, and I suspect he didn't mean this literally, as so many people in the White House these days don't mean things literally, but he said that Trump was so healthy that he might, the word might came in there, might live till he was 200 years old. So is this, as I think Vanity Fair was asking yesterday, is this the man we really want running the Veterans Administration?
He's also the guy that said Donald Trump weighs 239 pounds, and I can tell you as someone who is hefty.
Jackson also added the writer at the time that, you know, if he's if his diet had been a little less a little less concentrating on those Big Macs.
As being someone big myself, and at various times in my life, when I was approaching 300 pounds, and actually when I was at one point, I won't even say, when I was 415 pounds, people would ask me what I would weigh, and and for some reason, with people who are fat, 280 to 290 is a night. And then for people that are not as fat, 250, it's right in that mid range of the 200 that you always pick.
Well, yes, in the realm of relativity, yes.
And skinny but people, no, I mean, skinny people don't know.
What's interesting is that the media reaction, and this is what we're here to talk about, to Ronny Jackson's appointment. Has concentrated on the fact that he's a friendly, affable physician, certainly. And I think one thing that's really telling is that, like several, well, many, I guess, and until John Bolton broke the mold by having this peculiar late Victorian handlebar moustache, it was evidence of Trump's capacity for picking cabinet secretaries and other people in important positions on the basis of whether they sort of looked the part, sort of Hollywood. In fact, at one point, he is credited with saying about Ronny Jackson that he was a Hollywood star dressed in his admiral's uniform, standing erect at the podium, proclaiming about the president's health. That's the sort of basis on which people are being chosen these days. And you get what you fantasize about. I guess.
Doesn't he have to be confirmed?
That's a matter of fact. I'm not clear about this. I don't know. I suspect not in that position. But no. The VA, of course.
He does have to be confirmed.
And the Senate will be questioning it. Members of the Senate responsible will be questioning him closely. The media preoccupation following the president's lead so often with people's looks and suitability in that sense for the position are taking much more prominent position in media coverage than the issue at the heart of this, which is a dialogue. Who knows? It seems one-sided from what we hear about what's being said inside the White House. The degree to which reform or change, at least, even if it's not actual reform, in that vast sprawling bureaucracy of the Veterans Administration is going to take the form of privatization or not, or what degree of privatization. That's the issue that's not being discussed as fully as it should, because it's a lot easier to talk about Ronny Jackson's opinion about Trump's health and his suitability because of the way he looks.
My point, I'm sorry, being that this is where pretty much it appears, at least now, that every every news nugget comes in a beautiful box that talks about this instead of, I don't care if you know or don't know that he has to be confirmed, but I do care that the average 20 whatever, 30 whatever, looks at that and may not know.
Yeah, and it's the media's job to point out, and if I'd been reading more carefully, I would have more swiftly remembered that indeed confirmation is necessary here. It goes back. It is the media's responsibility to tell me. It's my responsibility, especially if I'm going to broadcast myself, to actually remember. But we go back to something that I know I've said on this segment many times before. A fundamental mission was given to me, and I suspect to you in your early days as communicators. My boss a long time ago said to me that on television, that was the medium we worked in then, we must never underestimate the intelligence of our audience, but we also must never overestimate their knowledge. And that's a very good guideline.
It's a really good guideline, and it seems to have fallen out. And so this brings me to my next question, which is, is there still an editing and a production layer? Are there still people who say, hey, you know, this is...
Well, it's very evident from the outcome, from the results of all the processes that work in producing the media that we consume, is that that layer is getting preciously thin. And then, yes, not a lot of that interventionist kind of editorial checking, of course, fact checking and style checking and overall quality checking. Quality control is one of the essential roles of an editor in any journalistic enterprise.
And what makes that worse is that over the past 20 years, major networks, including NPR and including other radio networks, have taken their correspondents in the field and sliced them probably by 70%.
Sure.
So it puts more pressure on correspondents in the field, actually in locations, to cover more stories, file more stories, to less people who edit those stories.
Yeah, the message right across the entire media landscape is do more with less. And that, of course, gives you the stresses and strains that end up with errors, omissions, and downright horrible disasters, horrible media disasters sometimes. And it's happening not just where you'd sort of expect it, but, you know, famously or infamously, it's happened even at one of those centers of excellence in media, which you all know and listeners will know. That I think the New York Times is a particularly fine example of journalism I'm not going to say it's absolute best, but it is on the whole a center of excellence. But even it has had its middle layer, as you call it, quite rightly, I think, in the cake of overall journalism, of the editorial bank of copy editors has been hollowed out. And as a very, unavoidable, it seems, and their management would say necessary, cost-saving drive. It's sad and it's regrettable and it's dangerous, I think, in the long run.
You've been talking about this and you talked about the veterans. I just have to stretch this out a little bit, and this story really got to me. The U.S. Army veteran who was served two tours in Afghanistan was deported. He had applied for U.S. citizenship, and he put down everything. He had a drug conviction, despite two tours, and the fact that he has PTSD. At 39 years of age, they deported him. That's a huge problem to me. It shows that the immigration service and the veterans service don't talk to one another.
Any time that you even peer into one of these stories, you will find just diabolical inconsistencies all the way through. And so that just shows how, and then something like this will be thrown onto the layer, and people focus on that again without looking. You don't get a complete picture, and this is where I want.
You would just think that your wartime service would get you that final okay. You can become a citizen, but if you screw up, you would think that would happen.
You would think that there are a lot of things that you would think, yeah. And I'm not minimizing this.
The three most dangerous words in reporting. That's
right.
That's been my experience. You would think,
right?
And of course, you turn out to be wrong when you would think.
But the thing is, if you would think that, and this is the key. And I was going back to school newspapers this morning when I was. Sort of reviewing this, you start with you would think, and the first thing you want to do is find out why. How could something this inconsistent and ridiculous happen, whatever it is? And that becomes the nugget,
yeah,
the next reporting exercise
is to say, well, you know, you would think this, but what is the fact? I mean, what does this agency A speak to agency B in cases like this? And, you know, what is the normal form here? And then what in this particular instance has been going on? Is the form being observed, or is there some sort of mess up in this particular case? I mean, that's how journalism generally works. So especially investigative journalism, when you're looking for the defective part in the machinery, as it were, after an air crash and that kind of thing, you are looking at, you know, why there was a financial crash. You look at what the system's supposed to be, then you find out where the case that's come to your attention fits into that mold or doesn't fit into that mold. And it's based in part, as all critical thinking is based on you would think, wouldn't you? But it's also based in this straightforward, cold, rational assessment of, you know, this is the way things are and this is the way things are supposed to be, and where does this particular story fit into that scale? And therefore, you know, at the end of the day, do you have a story in the end or not? Is it an outrage, or is it just a little crinkle, or what is it? But when you've done your work thoroughly, then you can say. But until then, it's best just as, unlike most, you know, journalists, who so-called journalists, I think, because you've abandoned the actual trade when you're doing this. When all you're doing is filling airtime, and you can leap to the immediate position of outrage before you even checked out the story. Yeah, exactly.
And now we only have 2 minutes left, and I've been dying to ask you this question for a couple of weeks now, ever since it happened. What about the bombings in Texas that took place?
It took place during South by Southwest Festival when I was there. Yeah. Well, some of them did. There were six bombs, five explosions at the end.
How did you see not only your reaction, but other people's reaction at South by Southwest?
Well, it was interesting to see a community on edge again. As you know, some listeners may know too, but I spent a lot of time in Britain and the United Kingdom in Northern Ireland and in the rest of the United Kingdom during what the Irish call the Troubles. And much of that that period of violence in Irish and British relations involved shooting violence and, of course, bombing violence. And for a large part of the IRA, the Irish Republican Armies, campaign, they took a tactical decision to bomb cities and the mainland of Britain so as to give the British electorate a sense of what it might be like to live in the state of terror, and that was exactly what they were aiming for, that prevailed in much of Northern Ireland's communities. And it's interesting, the Brits sort of got used to it. But it was, I'd kind of forgotten what it's like when it first happens. And in this case, and of course the head of the police force in Austin has now said that this was a case, he's prepared to use this label now, although at the time of the investigation and the bombings themselves, he was cagey about it. He now calls it a case of terrorism. And it's interesting, when terrorism first strikes, it is very, very unsettling. And as you know, Austin is a very laid-back city, a very comfortable place about itself and with itself. And during these days, weeks of unexplained bombings, without an evident rationale, and there still isn't one really, it's extremely unsettling. And it takes you back to the literal meaning of the word terror. The whole idea is to make people frightened to the point of terror. And of course, you know, at its base, it can work. And it's distressing how much it does put a community into a state of mind that is so uncertain that you can see, you know, if you extrapolate the picture to a wider canvas, you can see people starting to question essential matters like civil rights. Legal rights and safeguards and so on, There's a lot of impatience with the police force and that kind of thing that goes on when a community is struck by random bombing like this.
All right. Well, we're glad you made it through it and you had fun again at South by Southwest.
Thank you.
Glad to be there on your behalf.
Well, you'll be back next year, I suppose. Thank you.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.